I'm Lina Khmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at the impact of climate change on people's health and survival. Later in the program, we will have an exclusive interview with renowned Senegalese musician Baba Mar, who shares his thoughts on the devastation of desertification in Africa, particularly in his country, Senegal. But first, researchers and policymakers gathered in Washington, D.C. last week to shed a light on issues related to climate and health for Africa. Among other things, they discussed early warning signs for infectious disease, heat, drought, flooding, crop impacts, and other consequences of climate change, as well as how countries can take action to address the impact of climate on populations on the African continent. VOA's Amina Page spoke to Susan Rumisha, Senior Research Officer with the Malaria Atlas Project, Australia, and asked if drought could lessen the impact of mosquito-transmitted diseases like malaria or dengue.
You have malaria and you have the vector, who is a mosquito, and you have some conducive environment for the vector to be able to breed. And when you have drought, I think it's like you don't have those conducive environment for the vector to be able to breed. So it could be like beneficial in a way, because it means maybe they won't have water standing wells and places that they could actually breed. But so I would say you might benefit from malaria a little bit because the vector needs those environments to breed. But now what is coming next is like when you have people and they have drought, they have to find a way to cope with that. And one of the things is about they'll find ways to get water. So, for example, because you mentioned dengue, they will also have like storage containers. They will find a way to get from somewhere else, and then they'll keep them into the houses. So that now, I think it will be much more problem for dengue, because the dengue mosquito now, they don't need these ponds and everything. They just need those little water containers for them to breed. So they may be actually creating much more conducive environment for dengue mosquitoes in those areas. But drought also sometimes comes with a lot of heat. So that temperature also, and it depends on how high it goes, it might actually not be beneficial for the vector. So it could be like as bad as for the people and everything and economy and agriculture, but it might actually, yes, benefit a little bit for this. Depends on also this variation of temperature and where the water bodies now are formed.
Outside of climate forecasting, are there any simpler or cheaper preventative measures for diseases like malaria?
Cheaper. Oh. I think nothing is cheap for preventing of a disease like malaria. Everything it has its own cost. If it won't cost the health system, it will cost the household. If it won't cost the household, it will cost a mother. If it won't cost a mother, it will cost some communities. So forecast, what it helps you actually is to tell you what is going to happen tomorrow. So it helps you actually to prepare. So that is a part that forecast brings into the role of malaria control and prevention. But everything that we are trying to balance, like what is a cost benefit that you are trying to look at it here. That if I know in advance that malaria is going to be like upsurge in this area, it's going to be spiking, it's going to be more than what I expected, can I be able to prevent this community or to use the already tools that are already available? For example, use of net, making sure that if there is any chemo prevention for the kids, that they make sure that they use those drugs in the way they are supposed to use them so that their kids are protected. And maybe if they have to spray their houses, then they will have to make sure that their houses, they are allowing the people who are coming to spray those houses. So that, it helps you to reduce the cost later. So it won't reduce the cost of spraying. The cost of spraying will still be there. The cost of distributing the nets for the health system will still be there. And it'll be the same because we need to get those nets to the people. But that forecast helps them now. Once they utilize those interventions better, tomorrow the cost will be less because there'll be less people who are sick It means there'll be less people who they need drugs. There'll be less people that they are, maybe they are affecting their economy because now the household is healthy. So it means nobody has to be sick, or the mother has not have to go to the farm because now my child is sick, or maybe the father is not is well now, so they can do the economic activities, which is that is actually is that cost benefit. So it's actually how you balance that. But I wouldn't say there's any, there'll be like a reducing of that is not costly, but because the interventions, they are always, they will always need money. It's like, but that uptake, that knowledge of the future helps them, the community, to be alert. Then it actually, it makes other factors to be like less affected. So it means it makes their life much, their livelihood actually better. So there's kind of a cost benefit there, but it's just to answer that question the way direct, the way you asked, it's like it's gonna be beneficial into other aspects, which it generally they'll make their livelihood better, and maybe they also maybe the cost also be better. So I'm in public health, I'm a more malaria scientist and modeler, and we have this group that they are doing a lot of climate modeling, and they are also doing climate forecasting. So how we are picking it from here now going forward is to build those networks between these two groups, so that if we can have, because in my work, maybe I should get back a little bit of that. If in my work, we also use climate data, but more to predict. It's like when you are predicting, it means you are able to see malaria or to predict malaria in area that you didn't have data. For example, this data that we are testing people, you don't have data from the surveillance systems. So it means now it will tell you this area, there will be malaria or there is malaria. But the forecast, the network that we are going to build from here, they are going to help us to see beyond in terms of time. So it means what is going to help for once we are able to establish those networks and make them strong and be able to work together, then we can have maybe the best data in terms of climate data to help us now to understand the future of what is going to happen in terms of the vector, in terms of the disease, in terms of the impact into the communities. This is going to help us to plan better for the future in terms of malaria. But even other diseases, not only malaria. But on top of that, it's about allocating of the resources, because we've been talking to the NOAA here and other people who are doing a very good modeling for climate data. Some of them, they have very good data to very specific locations, very, I would say, high, we call it high resolutions. It means you can be able to tell what is a climate value at specific location, maybe up to 1 kilometer resolution. That is helping, so what we call risk stratification. What does that mean? It's like you take a country, for example, then you understand the malaria surface, like the malaria risk, and you can be able to create different clusters, like different polygons, like what, where exactly malaria is a problem. With the limited resource that we have in most of these African countries, I'll call it limited, why? Because there are a lot of competing priorities for the same money that we have. Even the government, even if it's contributing to that, is competing to get to be used in so many areas. So it means once you know where to tailor the money, it means you get the best impact of the control intervention that you are actually applying or employing into this community, and you get a boost in the impact of malaria. So it's like you invest maybe minimal with a optimal impact. So that's where the forecast with the good data is going to help us. So, and that's what I'm going to build from here, is to go with those networks to make sure that I can work with those people and they can also work with me. I'll be open, like, to be able that what can I share, what can I, where are my needs and where are their needs, so that we can work together in the future for malaria specifically, which I know it best, certifying the risk and maybe having very tailored interventions. So that is one thing that I see. Another thing that we see from here, I've met people here that they are using models that I've never used, but I didn't even know about them. So there was also a methodological aspect of that. Some of these models, we can adapt them into understanding the malaria also and other relationships. So it's also about learning from them, see if they are ready to share those models, and we could actually use them and adapt them to understand another area of the diseases. Then collaborating, training people, because now we are pushing this for Africa, where we know that some of the skills are not available. So it's about, and some of them, they have done already some of the trainings. So it's about going forward, it's about working with them to be able to leverage what they have already, what we need, because they already have our priorities in an area that would have loved to build these analytical skills. Then we can work with them to do that, because what we want in the future is this African ownership, the leadership. Then they, but I can't be a leader if I know, I'm not sure if I know what I'm doing, it can compete into the world. So I want to boost that skill, to build those people, that's confidence of people that they see, ah, I can do this and I can do it very well, even if it's challenged, I am able to defend it. And that is the area I would like to build our young generation, our young modelers. Area could be mathematical, geospatial modeling, anything, biological modeling, but they have to get that confidence that something I think we see is lacking in Africa. And you, people, they tend to do simple things because they know them better. But if you teach them and you train them and you give them opportunity to work with people that they can be able to build those skills, I think they become confident. And that confidence brings the ownership and brings the leadership.
That was Susan Rumisha, Senior Research Officer with the Malaria Atlas Project Australia, speaking to VOA's Amina Page. Experts say climate-informed forecasts for the African continent can help to anticipate and prepare for the risks associated to the effect of climate on people's health. At the Climate and Health in Africa conference, I spoke with Wasila Chow, research meteorologist and international desk head with NOAA, NOAA Climate Prediction Center, for more on the subject.
Climate has a big impact when it comes to health, but a lot of time we don't hear much about it. But we've seen that in the past 10 years, there have been a momentum, especially around climate change. First and foremost, what are your thoughts on what we are observing on the continent with regards to the impact of climate?
Yes, we all know that the globe has been warming and has been warming for a long, long time. So, and obviously with that warming, there are consequences. That is, it manifests with extreme events, climate events, and it's happening all over Africa, actually happening globally, but so Africa is not an exception. And every single region in Africa is affected. So we see more and more frequent droughts, frequent floods, also extreme heat events. So those have definitely impacts on the livelihood of people. So clearly it's affecting the livelihood, it's affecting also the health of the people, it's affecting food security, nutrition, and so forth. So I think that we now know that absolutely there are impacts are being felt, and maybe there is something that we need, we can do about that to at least minimize the risk of the impacts on the livelihood of people.
So how do you minimize the risks? What part can people play?
What we can do is early warning system, to develop advanced, effective early warning systems. And when we say early warning systems, meaning that to make forecasts that are actionable. But for those forecasts to be actionable, we need to work collaboratively. It has to be multidisciplinary. That is, the meteorologists, the forecasters bring their forecasts, but we need to understand the vulnerability to extreme events so that we can integrate that vulnerability data with the forecast. And then we need to co-develop the early warning system, and we also need to have a mechanism to disseminate this early warning so that it can access people can access them and make use of them. So it requires a lot of education, but also it requires institutional commitment. So government need to be engaged for any effective early warning system to be effective. The Climate and Health for Africa, this will be focusing primarily on health, because health is really the area where we think that there are some low-hanging fruit that haven't really been explored very widely. So, but now with advances on in climate forecasting, we're thinking that perhaps we could really try to start a conversation on implementing early warning system in health. So that's the conversation that we have been having in this conference. It's a four-day conference where we brought in experts from the climate sector, the health sector, but also the policy specialists and the program managers, funding agencies, so that we can have a discussion and see how we move climate-based health early warning system forward. So it's a conference that has been very well attended, and especially by African participants. And I think that one of the deliverables of this conference will be to follow up this conference where we have discussed ideas with smaller workshops on climate and health to try to explore opportunities for developing pilot projects, because early warning system need to start at a smaller scale. And then once you can implement at a smaller scale, you can expand it at a much larger scale.
So what will an effective early warning system look like and allow?
An effective early warning system, in my opinion, will be to prepare reliable, as accurate as possible, weather and climate forecasts, to work collaboratively with the social scientists. And when I say social science, I talk about people who work in behavioral science, understand how people react to extreme events, but also talking to, working with epidemiologists, you know, who understand the dynamics of diseases, working with community organizations, you know, so that all this research that is being done need to be translated into action, right? So we have to have the operational forecast. We need to do some research to that will be feeding into improving the forecast. The vulnerability data need to be improved. And then working collaboratively, we co-produce the early warning system. And now, of course, communication of the early warning system is a key component. Education is a key component, because even if you have an early warning system and you don't educate the people on the benefit of using the advice that we give in the early warning system, it will not be effective. So we have to really communicate with the people. We need to also find a way to engage the younger generations, you know, through cultural and sport organizations, you know, even at school, really make them understand the benefit, the interest in using climate information, so that they can start factoring that, you know, into their lives, and because they're going to be also the leaders of tomorrow. So the biggest challenge we have today is to have our decision makers integrate climate action plan into their policies. So if we educate now the younger generation, they're going to be the leaders of tomorrow. So it's going to make it just much easier to implement this early warning system moving forward.
Worship Ayodele Makun, thank you so much for joining us. First and foremost, why is it important for a young person such as yourself to be interested in this topic?
So as a young person coming from the background in Nigeria and the aspects, the people I grew up with, it's very important to be as a frontier in climate change, understanding how climate works, understanding how it affects every aspect of our lives, not just in the aspect of health, but also our environment and biodiversity. So coming from this background as a very young person, it is very important, because we are the ones that would, you know, continue teaching people how to learn and understand climate change. You know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, they will still be there. And if we don't address or mitigate or adapt to these things right now, they are going to affect us greatly. And what will become of the next generation to come? It's not just us. So we shouldn't just think about ourselves now. We should also think about the next generation coming. So this is a very important aspect to think about and advocate for also. In my city and, you know, places I've conducted research on in Nigeria, it's happening, it's real, and it's there. And, you know, either we close our eyes to it and just say, oh, it's not there, we are just going to, whatsoever happens, whatsoever God allows to happen, it's not going to change what is already happening. And it is evident. The research I conducted recently on Lagos and Kano showed that in 50 to 100 years from now, we'll be facing very serious magnitude of heat. And it's because of the increase in temperature, and it's already happening. So, yes, it's evident. Climate change is evident in my country, evident in places also in my country. So we can contribute our own quota by raising awareness. We have our age group where we can raise awareness, and we are very used to social media, so we can use all forms of social media to raise awareness to people that, okay, this is what is happening, this is climate change. Another aspect that should be looked into is innovation and technology. So I know as young minds, we have a very high level of creativity. So I think that needs also to be delved into. We need to create, learn how to create stuff, and then how to also, you know, be innovative in whatsoever area. Then creativity in form of art also is widely accepted. So any little thing that we can, and also voice out our voice, let people know that, yes, we are ready for this. Let me give you a very simple example. In Nigeria, we have this thing that we call pure water sachet, where we take water from water bags and we drink it, but then it's just disposed anyhow. And this leads to, you know, blockage of drainage. It causes pollution in the environment. So as young people, if I were to relay this message to my peers, I would tell them that we could use and recycle these water bags for planting. Yeah, so that is reusing, and, you know, it will also help the environment, because now we don't have to dispose our water bags unnecessarily, and it will cause reduction in pollution and also help to recycle the water bags that we are using for planting also. So my main takeaway from this conference is how to, you know, improve and provide early warning systems for my country and Africa at large. So where we can use early warning systems to be able to detect things that can affect us now and later in future, so that we can apply and start looking for ways to either prevent, mitigate, or adapt to these issues.
Wasila Thiaw, research meteorologist and international desk head with NOAA, and researcher Worship Ayodele Makun were speaking to us from the Climate and Health in Africa Conference in Washington, D.C. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. When we return, we'll have an exclusive interview with Senegal music sensation Baba Mal. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. June 17 was World Day to Combat Desertification and Drought, with the theme Her Land, Her Rights. According to the United Nations, women make up around half of agricultural workers in developing countries and produce 60 to 80% of food grown in these regions, yet own less than one-fifth of all land worldwide. When land degrades and water and other resources become scarce, women and girls are exposed to poverty, hunger, displacement, and violence. I spoke to Under Secretary General of the United Nations and Executive Secretary of the UN Convention to Combat Desertification, Ibrahim Thiaw, who said that women and girls in Africa were critically impacted by desertification, and women's access to land is a key to achieving the SDGs. Take a listen.
When we say desertification, many people understand it's deserts. No, we are talking about land loss, loss of fertile land. It can be in the middle of a forest or savanna, or it can be in an arid land. But the point is that with the food systems that we have at the moment, we are degrading our land in a very rapid pace. According to our statistics, 1 hectare in 4 from around the world is already lost. And if the statistics continue like this, by 2050, 90% of the all ice-free land in the world will be not necessarily lost, but it will be impacted by human activities. So this is the situation where we would like the world to understand that we have enough land and we can produce enough food to have to live a decent life without necessarily depleting the natural capital upon which we live. We are 8 billion people today in the world. We live on land and we live off land. So it is absolutely critical that we feed the entire community in the world. But we should do it in a way that is compatible with the principles of sustainable development. And we can do it. Now, if we are to achieve that, we have to address the inequalities that we were talking about in terms of women's access to land.
Data show that women make up almost half of the agricultural labor force in developing countries, but they are very limited in terms of access to land rights. Would you share with us the state of women's and access to land?
Only 15% of agricultural land is registered for women in the world. whereas they are actually 45% of the workforce. The reason why we are addressing this issue at the UN Desertification and Drought Day is precisely to put a spotlight on this issue, in addition to being not just, but it is not the right path that we need to take if we are to achieve the sustainable development goals. Essentially, there are very few laws, written laws, against women's land rights, but there are a lot of customary laws, a lot of traditions that go against the equality that we are all aspiring at in terms of women's access to land.
What can world leaders do? How can they take urgent action on women's land rights?
But we need more policies to change the situation. The narrative that we talked about is, again, coming from sometimes from customary laws, sometimes from traditions, sometimes wrongly, sometimes attributed to religions. All of that needs to change, and it will change through regulations. It will change through incentives that can be put in place. It can change through programs, specific programs targeting women's access to land. It can change through land restoration programs. When land is degraded and being put back to health, it can be targeted for specific groups to benefit from. And there are multiple initiatives that can be promoted by countries.
Can you talk us through Her Land, Her Rights campaign? What are you hoping to achieve?
Her Land, Her Rights campaign is essentially meant to create the awareness in the world. Most campaigns that have been led so far in terms of gender equality have been addressing either elections, selections, recruitments, positions in governments. These are all very important, but very few have been talking about land and women's access to land, women's land rights. So it is certainly one of the largest campaigns we would like to see, together with our colleagues from the UN Women Organization, the United Nations, with the UN Human Rights Commission, with the Food and Agriculture Organization, with the UN Development Programme. We hope that we will continue to join forces and we will galvanize other actors, including non-state actors, to actually continue this campaign. It's not only one day. The campaign will continue for a full year. And our hope is that it will continue even beyond 12 months.
That's Ibrahim Chow, Under Secretary General and Executive Secretary of the UN Convention to Combat Desertification, UNCCD. He was speaking to us from the UN headquarters in New York. That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, with producer Mukbil Yabaro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1. Then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA.
VOA Africa Radio, we let the sound tell you the story. News, sports, science, and entertainment available to you 24/7. Tune in on your local FM stations. We are also available on the medium waves, 909 kHz and 1530 kHz. Short waves are 60-80, 15 580, 4930, 15 165, 15 580, and 17 530 kilohertz. VOA Africa, your trusted source for news and